personally, I found it very difficult to take the no planes hypothesis seriously until I recognized that there was a logical distinction between no planes and video fakery. And for those of you who are following the press releases from scholars, you may have read my recent release about the possibility of video fakery, which it seems to me has been substantially strengthened by September Clues. By the September Clues release, which Peggy Carter has been playing at least in part, which is archived on the scholars' website. Now, what's important here, it seems to me, is that there's a tremendous amount of evidence that I take to be compelling of video fakery. On the other hand, you could have had planes present where the video fakery was intended to conceal features of the planes or of their interaction with the building, which would be very consistent with Dave von Kleist's hypothesis.
Thank you.
But the point I'm making is also this. The controversy obviously remains unresolved, and I'm just congratulating myself for having organized the program, but this session is on Sunday. And I'm going to say, too, that when we get to the end, I'm going to invite, you know, everyone up here who wants to make a comment about the conference or any aspect of it to have that opportunity. I put the checkout time back to 1 o'clock, by the way, so you don't have to check out before 1 o'clock. And we will have entertainment from Ace Baker during our lunch in the O'Dana room for everyone who has a ticket. So I'm going to invite now, I'm going to introduce our speaker. He's a music composer, producer, co-composer for American Dragster on ESPN. He's been a composer of many independent feature films and scoring for film and television. He works with digital video on a daily basis. He's completed a study of television film fakery involving the hit on the South Tower, which is entitled Chopper 5 Composite, and which I find to be an in-depth study that complements the breadth of September Clues. I just want to encourage all of you, some of whom may be encountering these issues for the first time, to review the videos of September Clues and to take a look at the study by our next speaker. Please join me in welcoming Ace Baker.
Well, good morning, everybody. I'd like to thank Jim Fetzer for inviting me to come and speak to you this morning. I'm going to start out by just saying a little bit about who I am and what I do and how that might relate to 9/11. As he mentioned, I am a musician. You might have to bear with me a little bit. We weren't able to get my computer hooked up, so I'm working off of a different thing here. But in my past life, I used to go on the road and play in some bands. Oh, how do we get the audio of this? Of this thing? How do you get it on?
You just put it up here. That's good. Okay, here's the plug.
Here's the plug,
Whoa. Oh, this is so ghetto. Anyway, a long time ago, this is back from 1993. I was in this band called Mother's Finest, and we played a lot of really big shows in Europe. I'll skip to where you can see me a little bit, but this is probably some 20,000 or more people. Now, why doesn't this work, Jim? Here we go. Maybe in here somewhere. Where am I? I'm the keyboard player, see, so they'll hide me. You know, as much as possible. There I am, woo! we played some big shows and we had some fun. These days I'm more of a film and TV composer. Here's just a little bit of an interview that was done.
Four movies within one movie, and they all sort of interrelate.
but I thought it was clear that each of the four subplot and each of the four main characters had their own musical theme and their own sound associated with them. Beth is obsessed with what
guy in some story. We got bad guys. That's Osama and the terrorists that hate your freedom. We have high stakes conflict, right? It's about life and death. It's about freedom. It's about our very way of life. Universality of theme, in other words, is something that everybody can relate to. Everybody can relate to the fear of death. So we know that it's a good story, and so we know that it's going to affect people emotionally. Now, notice that in this formula for a good story, truth is not part of the equation. Okay, so it just doesn't enter into it. It's just not part of the calculus for that. So that's just something to keep in mind. I told you a little bit about who I am. I'm going to quickly step through a little bit of the No Planes research that I encountered from other researchers as I started getting into this. And then we're going to get into my velocity analysis and what that is all about. And then I'm going to hit some of the criticism of the paper that's actually come out just in the last few days that I think if there were any doubts in my mind about what I was doing with my velocity papers, based on the criticism that's come out, that has actually erased all doubts in my mind. And then I will offer just a couple of thoughts at the end, and then I'm going to try to leave it on a note of optimism at the end. Now, as I said, I'm a musician and a songwriter, producer. I score little movies, and I write my little songs. I heard a song a few years ago by Daryl Worley that was called Have You Forgotten, and the song made me mad. The song was about 9/11, and it was a very pro-war, very patriotic kind of a number. And I remember he started out his chorus by saying, "Have you forgotten how you felt that day?" And it's clear that the song is very, very effective at engendering this pro-war patriotism. Let's get angry and let's go kill these guys. But the point is that he wanted you to focus on what you were feeling, on how you felt. And we all felt scared and angry on 9/11. When I decided to do my version of that song and correct the lyrics for him, I changed the first line of that chorus to, "Have you forgotten what we saw as one?" Because I think it's much more important not necessarily to remember how we all felt that day, but rather to remember what we actually saw that day. So let me move on here. There are two sides to music production. Excuse me a second. There are two sides to music production. There is the highly creative, subjective side, just the raw musical ideas. And there's a much more highly technical side, having to do with actually recording the music, getting it nowadays into the computer, really to be a good recording engineer, you need to understand the physics of sound, how waves can be constructive or destructive, phase relationships, frequency relationships. And of course, a lot of the software tools that we use, very, very deep, high-end, complicated tools that we can manipulate and shape the sound in all sorts of ways. But it's about building that bridge between the purely subjective side of things. There's a lot of musicians who really don't relate to the technical side of things at all. You can ask a songwriter, why did you put the B-flat chord here? And you almost invariably get an answer like, "Well, it just felt right. Just feels good that you don't have a logical explanation." So, in my role and what I do, whether I'm doing all parts of those things, I see myself as being a bridge from the purely subjective side of things to the more technical side of things, both of which are necessary. And when I began looking at this no planes aspect of 9/11, I thought that some of the research, in fact, a good deal of it, seemed to fall into that category of stuff that you know, but you just can't prove, you know. And it reminded me of that guy who can't explain why he puts the B flat chord where he does. That it seems like it needs that bridge from the subjective. Like, for example, I'll show you the Now Day movie. Just a brief clip of, now this is the only real footage that we have of the first strike. I hope this, oh, you don't have the software to run this.
Can you play it though?
Huh?
It's very continual, just play it and set my beat. Try opening one more time for it.
You're on the web, go to dribblegate.com.
Yeah, maybe you can come and play. I don't think you have the AVI extension for your QuickTime. Okay. Well, that's going to hold us back on a few of these here, actually. But what you see in the Now Day that's important to the point I was just making is that you see, and of course this was in the firefighter documentary, they were supposedly looking for a leak of gas. They didn't find it. You know, the documentary is filming the guy, and they're standing around waiting for something to happen. And all of a sudden, one guy looks up, supposedly sees this plane in the sky, and the filmmaker, instead of looking up in the sky trying to find, whoa, what's going on, he does this perfect pan directly to the Twin Tower. It just happened to me in the middle of the street. I've actually been filming some of my own plane videos, and I've discovered something in big buildings, or in big cities, and that is, it's almost impossible to get a good shot of a tall building from the sidewalk, almost anywhere, because the other nearer buildings are in your way. You got to go in the middle of the street. Well, they're in the middle of the street. So, you know, to me, it's highly unlikely that he would just pan right over and frame up the Twin Tower. However, people sometimes do random weird things, so it's like not something that you can prove. So I just started thinking, maybe there's something I can look at that is just of a more objective, measurable nature to the whole thing. So, but now going back into my past, I love video fakery. I always have. 20 years ago, I was a young kid musician trying, and music videos were brand new at the time. And I went down to a little public access TV studio in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm sorry I don't have the clips to show you. But we made what's called a chroma key video. Now, you've all seen chroma key. And that is when, like, the news weathercaster stands in front of the weather map, okay? Well, they're not really standing in front of a weather map. And they're standing in front of a blue screen or a green screen, and the two pictures are being combined. Well, I had done up these little pictures of, like, cartoon-like scenes and sequences, and we went down to the studio, and we actually had to take one camera and point it at my computer monitor. And then we had another camera that was pointed at the blue screen with me on there, and we were able to superimpose me into cartoon land. And it was very, very fun, and I had little thought bubbles and little, you know, like, it was like a cartoonish, and we had fun with it. But one thing I learned, and this is going to be very important today to understanding these 9/11 videos, camera motion spoils the show. And you're creating an illusion, you've got a background and a foreground, but if we move the camera on the real object, that real object is going to move around, back and forth. And the background is not going to move correspondingly. And so that's going to be a dead giveaway that something is wrong. So I hope now that I can find this bookmark. going to go now on just a little brief history of video compositing. Now, can you see what's going on here? I'm going to play this over and over. Is this a real video, or is this a composite? Can anybody tell? I think it's a composite. We appear to see a guy shooting a Tommy gun out of a car. He's driving down the car very rapidly, chasing another car. And now, if somebody were to come to us, okay, and try to convince us that this is a real video, what could we do to try to prove that he's wrong, that this is in fact a video composite? Well, first thing you'll notice is that there's a very different quality between the background and the foreground. Okay, the background looks like a movie. The foreground guy doesn't so much, and that's because the background is a movie. The way this was done was a rear projected. There's an actual movie screen there, and they're projecting this movie of the car driving down the road. And then there's an actual real car, or a cutaway part of a real car, that the actor is sitting in, who is in front of that screen. Okay, so that's how they do it. Let's assume for a second that they solved that problem, that we couldn't see the difference in quality between the background and the foreground. Now, is there still something that we can look at that tells us that this is a video composite? Okay, I heard motion. Yes. Is that Peggy? Yes. Well, yeah, you're on to it. The first question that we would ask if we were trying to figure this out is, where is the camera? If this is a legitimate shot, okay, where is the camera? Is the camera mounted to the car? It seems to be staying pretty close to the car in the foreground. Is it mounted to the side of the car? Well, the answer is no, because if it was mounted to the side of the car would not move. I'm talking about the car in the foreground, would not move at all. The background and the road and the trees and so forth would move, but the car wouldn't move at all. So it looks like maybe like a helicopter, a small helicopter, could be flying right alongside that car to get that shot. Now, the next criticism we might say is, well, but the car in the foreground never gets any further or closer away. So we have to believe that the little helicopter flying alongside is exactly the same speed as huh?
Going around the road.
That's right. Following the turn, exactly. But let's assume some super great technology, and let's assume we solved that problem, that we've got a helicopter that can fly the exact same speed as that car right alongside of it, never get any further or closer to it. Is there still anything about this shot that tells us that it's a video composite?
I think the lack of light, the fact that it's had its shape on its head, it's low, it sticks its head out.
He has it glued on. It's a whole hairpiece. It's sewed into his scalp.
Well, that's all.
The answer, yeah, keep your thinking caps on, but we need to stay here because this is going to have a lot to do with it. The answer is yes, we can. There is still something about this that we can tell. That's exactly right. What Peggy just said is exactly right. Looking only at the background, we notice that the background has camera motion. We see a number of stationary objects. There's the road itself, the trees, the fence posts. So they're not moving, yet they appear to wiggle. And that wiggle comes from moving the camera. Any camera motion is going to affect the picture. And how it's going to affect that picture is in a very precise relationship to the camera movement. If you move it a little bit, the picture moves a little bit. And the entire picture moves. So what we notice here is that the camera motion on the background image is not present on the foreground image. There's all kinds of little wiggles and shakes and jiggles that you would have to see on that foreground. Otherwise, we know that it is a video composite. So this is the key thing to keep in mind just for a moment, that camera motion always affects the apparent position of things that are in the frame. Yes. Right. They do not correspond. What's actually taking place is the camera is not moving at all. It is parked. They're showing you a movie of what was a handheld or a car-mounted camera chasing that other one in the background. The guy in the foreground is in a set of a car, and there's some stagehands underneath there wiggling the car.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what's actually going on. But the thing to take away from this and to keep in your mind for a moment is that camera motion always affects what you see, and that it must affect the entire frame that's being shot consistently. That's exactly right. So, I got interested in 9/11. It's a good story. A couple years ago, I really thought Jim Hoffman's site was great. And, of course, Jim Hoffman was a supporter of real planes, and I read some of his stuff on that. And so for a long time, I just thought that that no planes was just to be dismissed, that it was a silly idea. And along came the scholars for 9/11 Truth and Jim Fetzer and company. And I know we got a little bit behind schedule, but before I actually get into some of this other stuff, if possible, I'd actually like to play a song. It's one that I almost feel that I can't not do. This song was sort of inspired by the work of Jim Fetzer and his life work, not just on 9/11, but on JFK and some other issues. And I had the first part of that. And the second part of the song was actually sort of written by the thought of this very conference at a time when I didn't know that I was going to be coming here to speak. So if you would just indulge me for the 3 minutes, I'd like to just, can I try just a little bit of this before we get into that? And then we'll get into it. Uh-oh. Alright. The next thing is that I don't play guitar, actually. I'm much more of a piano player, keyboard player kind of person, and I'd actually rather play that. But I inquired about the grand piano here at the Radisson, and it turns out that it's no longer available because somebody, now we don't know who, but somebody took the grand piano here at the Radisson, and they took it up to the top of the Twin Towers
and they pushed it over the edge to see how long it would take to hit the ground. It says it's not available. Let's try the guitar. Let's see if
Is there any rubble?
The what?
Is there any rubble?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think Stephen Jones has got some samples of it. We're not real sure about the chain of custody. It's funny, nobody bothered to take pictures or video of the thing falling. It's like the molten metal. We just don't know. So this is where, it's actually in the show, actually, I think a girl might have seen this, and she's at her absolute lowest point. She's had her affair with the president, and she is near suicide. She's starting to question everything and anything. Does July really follow June? Did Neil Armstrong really touch the moon? 911, was it as they say? And did Lee Oswald really take out JFK? Who you gonna believe? Who's telling lies? Because they're deceived. Hypnotized. If you wanna ask me, how do we get wise? I will believe my lying eyes. Take a look at this Tuesday talk. Watch this film and tell me what you saw. It can't be real, it's so impossible. Let's take this here, it's a fabricated thing. Fabricated. Who you gonna believe? You're telling lies. But could it be hypnotized? If you wanna ask me, how do we get wise? I will believe my lying eyes. We're the government fiction, throwing proscription, knocking me out like my brain's constriction. Hard to be breathing, sharing my freedom. Everything in my own damn government is feeding me. It's blind to be deceiving me. They sure not leaving me. It's way more evil for me than anything that I could ever conceive. So who you gonna believe? Who's telling lies? That girl is deceived. I will believe my lying eyes.
Okay, so I'm going to just walk real quickly through just a few of the things that that I encountered. I was writing an article for Morgan Reynolds' website. It's about 9/11 in general, and writing an open letter to a group of economists that I thought really ought to be on this case, but are not. Morgan called me up one day and had a question about just a couple of the things that I had said in there. And his question for me was, what planes? So that made me really start looking into this aspect of it. And the first, of course, is Ghost Plane, I believe, so named by Rosalie Grable. And so there it is. We can step back and forth through this, but as Morgan mentioned, there just appears to be a point in time where the plane has and the wings have penetrated, but there just doesn't seem to be any damage to the side of the building.
It's the
miraculous entry. Now, to the extent that there is an official explanation for this phenomenon, it is that the front leading edge of the plane atomized, broke into millions and millions of very little pieces, and sort of wrapped around all of the perimeter columns that were there and entered the building. And so when we ask, well, why didn't the tail of the plane slow down at all? To the extent that there's an answer, the official theorists will say, well, you actually have to consider the plane not as one entire structure, but actually as a collection of much smaller structures. Think of it as like a constellation of rocks flying in a building. Well, when the front rock hit, that wouldn't necessarily have any effect on the back ones. But it seems to me that this brings up a paradox. Now, I believe it might have been Holmgren who coined the term resistance paradox to describe a problem with the Twin Towers. On the one hand, we're supposed to believe that there was so little resistance that the building was able to fall at approaching free fall speed, and yet there was so much resistance that the entire building was able to be crushed and pulverized. By an analogy, I would like to bring out what I'll call the force paradox here, because on the one hand, we're being expected to believe that the plane is acting as a whole series of separate masses that can shatter and break and no longer have any connection to the rear of the airplane. But at a different time, we're being asked to consider the entire plane as one mass so that we can get this large mass, so that we can calculate this very large kinetic energy, which is supposedly equivalent to so many, however many thousands of tons of TNT. Well, it seems that it's going to be one or the other in some sort of a reciprocal relationship, and that it can't be both ways. Another one of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think another one of Webb Ferry-isms is the hippity-hop plane. Now, this is, I call this Chopper 7, and we'll just have a brief look at it. Now, I don't know if my playback is going to be glitchy, but you will see the plane flying, and you see some kind of irregular motion. We're going to break this down frame by frame and look at it, but it does, the first thing you notice is it does seem to have some kind of an irregular motion, and we also notice, well, what do we actually see here? Well, we see a plane crashing into a building, don't we? Well, not really. Actually, we see a plane slipping behind the edge of a building.
seems like. And then we have Chopper 5. Now, Chopper 5, also known as Pinocchio's nose here. First we'll look at the whole shot.
He hits the back sharply and smacks directly, perhaps purposefully, into... Oh, my goodness, there's another one.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness, there's another one.
It seems to be on purpose.
Oh. So, now...
It appeared to back sharply and smash directly, perhaps purposefully, into... Oh, my goodness, there's another one.
Now,
this
seems to be on purpose. Again, the instant it happens, they're not only telling you what you think you saw, but they're telling you this is on purpose, it's a terrorist, they're going to solve this crime in a few minutes for you. If I could get some more water, that would be great. What do we see in this? What do we not see? Well, we see a plane entering from the right side. We see that it slips behind that logo, so there's actually a frame missing that we can't even tell. Then it slips behind. Do we actually see it hit the tower? No. It slips behind the edge of that tower, and then whoops! It seems like it slips kind of out the back side, and we're going to look a little more closely at that in a minute as well. But backing up, when we zoom out in this zoom shot, hello, I don't really see an airplane out in this shot anywhere that it actually is supposed to be. Now, this is not a YouTube. This was actually digitized by Eric Salter from his VHS. This is a lower res digitization. He did a higher resolution one just for the little excerpt, which is the one I analyzed for my paper, but I would ask him to maybe do a higher quality digitization on this whole thing, because it'd be nice to look really hard and see if we can see an airplane in there anywhere. The next thing we notice is the cameraman does this zoom, and he's zooming in, and look at that, just within, well, let's see how many frames. One, he's still zooming, one, two. After two frames, that's, that's about 1/15 of a second after the zoom, that's when that plane comes in. That's a heck of a coincidence. It's up there with the nowadays miracle pan shot. So this is the miracle zoom. But again, people sometimes do random weird things. It's like, how do we prove it? But it was some very interesting get your mind going on it kind of stuff. Now, I had all my JPEGs. I don't know how these are even going to come up. But there's a guy called Still Diggin who has been doing some nice research. That's going to come up in preview. Okay, that's cool. And then, let's see, if I do another one, does that come up in the same thing? No, they're all going to be different, huh? So here's Tower 1, Tower 2. These blue lines are his calculated lines of sight that he has gotten. And these red lines here show you one tower width behind the twin towers. And so by knowing how far back in time the airplane is, these circles here where he's trying to plot where the airplane actually is. By knowing how far back in time it is, he knows how many tower widths it is behind the tower. By doing that geometry, he knows the line of sight. So he does that with both videos, and he plots, from one video, he plots the plane located at this point in space right here. From the other video, he plots supposedly the same plane at this other point in space here, 463 feet apart. Now, he was having some problems determining the distance that the camera was away from the shot. I'd actually like to suggest something to him or to anyone that wanted to continue this geometry research, because I think it could prove very, very fruitful in solving some of these questions. I think this dimension of this building right here could be known in reality. And we know the dimensions of the Twin Towers, and we know this building is in front of the Twin Towers by some distance, and we could know what that is. So by comparing the actual dimensions of this tower and that versus the apparent sizes of them, using the geometry of perspective, we could know exactly how far back that camera was, and I hope that somebody will continue with the problem determining the distance that the camera was away from the shot. I'd actually like to suggest something to him or to anyone that wanted to continue this geometry research, because I think it could prove very, very fruitful in solving some of these questions. I think this dimension of this building right here could be known in reality. And we know the dimensions of the Twin Towers, and we know this building is in front of the Twin Towers by some distance, and we could know what that is. So by comparing the actual dimensions of this tower and that versus the apparent sizes of them, using the geometry of perspective, we could know exactly how far back that camera was, and I hope that somebody will continue with the geometry research that he has that he's been doing. So it brings us to September Clues. Now, September Clues is a nice series of videos, and I recommend them to you. First, I'll bring up number two. It's broken into six parts right now. Our video, the quality is a little crappy. This is off of YouTube. So at 450, we've got the streak. All right. Sickening is a more appropriate term. He's going, okay. So here's a little respite. And a little. Oh, well, here we have some video fakery. Okay. Now, that's fake. It's a lot more realistic than the 9/11 videos. So here we're looking at some of these amateur videos that were... Now, this is the Bob and Bree. He notices that there's a black streak that goes through the gap in between the buildings, and he follows it. The quality is pretty crummy, but it is a very dark black streak that does not appear to have any wings on it. And you would just think that even as poor as the quality is, that if anything, you would see those wings coming across the same way you see the bottom of that airplane. Okay, now what you just heard, you saw the edit. There was an edit there where the plane supposedly came in. This is the Bob and Bree video that surfaced just about a year ago. They were in their apartment very close to the Twin Towers. The video obviously chops out whatever happened when the plane struck or whatever it was that happened. That part has been cut out for a few seconds, but the sound is perfectly continuous. Well, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, if they quit recording, then you wouldn't still capture that sound. I mean, the sound quits recording there, too. So, I mean, it's a little suspicious that maybe somebody just didn't want to see what that video was there, and they cut something out. Now, he brings up something that we might call a pixel bleed problems, and I'm going to look at that for a second, too. Let's see, that's at 7 minutes. So, in this video, this is the Hippity Hop, Chopper 7, or the Hippity Hop one. He's noticing as this blob appears to go behind the building that it sort of eats into that vertical line and makes that line go away a little bit. Now, is that sinister? Is that suspicious? I decided to do a little bit of looking of my own, and this is one of my control videos where I have a crappy video, and I'm going to see if the plane actually, after going through this, I made sure I compressed it really heavy so that it was really low quality. And what we learn is that light pixels tend to survive, and darker pixels tend to, or light pixels tend to go away, and darker pixels tend to survive. And so, although that might be a little inconclusive, I think it's definitely worth looking into this pixel bleed problem. Then we come to something that is very, very interesting. He calls identical twins. So we'll look at video number 3 here, and this is from September Clues by somebody called Social Service. And at 1:32,
it's the South Tower of the World Trade Center. 8:10 a.m. American Flight 77, a 757 with 64 aboard, has taken off from Washington's Dulles Airport, also bound for Los Angeles. It, too, taken over and loops back into the panic. It slices in at a panic.
Okay, so what you're seeing on the left is how that shot aired live. And what you're seeing on the right is apparently the same shot as it aired on the evening news. They've taken the background out. Now, why would they do that? Now, if you look, I don't know if we'll be able to see on this quality, because this is downloaded off of YouTube. You will see something on the shot that was actually aired live. You will see something that comes in from very high, right about up in here where I've got the pointer, and it just drops down, and then disappears. It doesn't look like a plane. It looks, it's just like a, almost like a, like a crease in the video. It's so tiny, and you can see it. But then when they re-ran it, they put like a plane or a dark something in there that was a lot easier to see, and they took the background out. I'm sorry. I find that a little suspicious that they would be taking the backgrounds out and putting dark things in. Yeah. Uh-huh. And that was from number 3 at 1:32.
This the actual plane as it hits the South Tower of the World Trade Center. 8:10 a.m.
American Flight 77. 757 with 64, or let's make an offer Washington right Delaware.
That's NBC. This is the local four.
Into the pit.
There are many, many versions of many of these.
And in terms of the firefighting capabilities, when we get up to the high level, I assume the firefighters have got to get up there and, fight it from inside.
Okay, let's see what the quality of this is. He's trying to zoom in on it. I mean, you do see like a little speck of something, but it sure doesn't look like a plane. It just doesn't look like a plane. And then yet, when they aired the same footage that night, all of a sudden there was a very discernible plane. And our background was gone.
That's the actual plane, and it hit the south tower of the World Trade Center. 8:10 a.m., American Flight 77, 757 with 64, or has taken off from Washington's Dulles Airport, also bound for Los Angeles.
This is the same footage. He's got them synchronized.
Loops back into the plane. Explains it.
So it's troubling. And then he's got this 17-second delay, which I think is also a clue. We use the thing when I score music to picture, we have a two-pop, which is just a little flash and a beep at the beginning of the film. That is for synchronization. When I do my music and I deliver it back, we need to make sure that the music is in the right place and didn't get slipped ahead or behind where it's supposed to be. So we have the sync pops, the beeps and flashes and things that help us line things up in time. Maybe that's what's going on here.
We've got Sean Murtaugh, he's the CNN producer on the telephone right now. Sean, what can you tell us about the United States?
This is Sean Murtaugh, president of Finance for CNN.
Yeah, Sean, you're on the air right now.
Go
ahead, what can you tell us?
I just witnessed a plane that appeared to be cruising slightly lower than normal altitude over New York City, and it appears to have crashed into, I don't know which tower it is, but it hit directly in the middle of one of the World Trade Center towers.
Sean, what kind of plane? Was it a small plane?
It was a jet. Looked like a two-engine jet, maybe a 737.
You're talking about a large passenger commercial
large
jet.
Large passenger commercial jet.
This plane, the 737, has crashed into this speculation at this point.
Okay, I might be in the wrong place of his movie. He's making the point that almost all of the witnesses who called in to say they had seen a plane all worked for the mainstream media. That was Sean Murtaugh, who's the financial vice president of CNN. The point that he's making is that there appears to be a 17-second delay between when this live event of whatever happened on Building 2 happened and when that was actually broadcast, and that could be important in trying to figure out how they might have done it. So, this section I'm going to call Puzzlement and the Judy Wood Doctrine. So like I said, like the musician who can't explain why he puts the B flat chord where he does. A lot of this was just seeming like that it was very subjective, and I was just wondering if there was anything that I could do that would provide some empirical backbone to what I thought was already a very, very strong case. Morgan kind of went through the logical case of if you accept the inside job theory generally, I think by
just going through the different options that the perpetrators would have in trying to sell this story about hijacked planes that go into these buildings and cause these big fires and make them collapse. You know, real planes or fake planes, drones versus real passenger aircraft, you go through all of the different permutations of that. I think you'll find that having no real plane and faking the video actually is your least risky, it's your least risky way to go about it. And real planes leave real evidence. So to figure that out, though, I started trying to put my mind into the mind of the perpetrator. If I'm going to do this, how am I going to do it? And I'm going back to the music video I made 20 years ago where we put me into the cartoon land, and I'm thinking about some of the software tools that I use now, and I'm thinking about, okay, I know that I can put a plane on top of a picture. I know I can do that. I know I can mask off the edge so that it appears to disappear behind the tower. I know I can do that. But I kept thinking and being reminded of the problem we discovered when we were making our little video, and that is that going handheld spoils the show. When you move the camera and one thing is moving, but the background isn't moving correspondingly, that is what is the dead tip-off that you're compositing. Just like that old movie we saw and the camera motions didn't match. I started thinking, they have to use helicopters. Why? It's the biggest news event ever, right? You can't have 9/11 without news helicopters, can you? If there were no helicopter shots, everybody would be going, where were the helicopters? Plus, helicopters are great for going up and getting exactly where they want to be. Sometimes down on the ground, you can't get where you need to be. There's something blocking your way. So we have to have helicopters. But helicopters have a problem. Helicopters cannot hold still. A helicopter camera shot is going to be unstable. No matter how you try to stabilize it, you have this vessel that's bobbing and weaving in the air. So if I'm thinking of how I'm going to put a fake plane onto a helicopter shot, I've got a problem. Because if the motion of my airplane is perfectly smooth, that's an impossibility. It is impossible to get a perfectly stable shot of an airplane from a helicopter. But the problem is, how do I anticipate the motion that helicopter shot ahead of time so that I can make sure that my overlay shot of the airplane moves accordingly? I didn't have an answer. I thought about it. Now, I figured maybe I was getting a little bit ahead of myself. So I allowed myself to be admonished by what I'll call the Judy Wood Doctrine. Judy has said that over and over and over again, before we figure out how something was done or why it was done or who might have done it, first we need to look at what was done. So what do these videos actually show, or what do they not show? So I'm going to pull up Chopper 5 and Chopper 7, and we'll just have a little side-by-side comparison. Now here's the excerpt of Chopper 7. What's going on with your box, Jim? Wait a minute. Where am I? Oh, I don't want to buy anything. Wait a minute now. All right. What do we see? We see a plane coming in from the right disappearing behind the edge of the tower. There's a missing frame, and they get out of the shot as quickly as possible. They fade to black at the very end very, very quickly. What do we see in this shot? Well, we see a plane entering from the right. It disappears behind the edge of the tower, and they get out of the shot as quickly as possible. And we're also going to notice that there's a frame missing out of this one as well. In both shots, the helicopter that's shooting this appears to be drifting slightly to the left. As I step through this, you can see that the helicopter is drifting slightly to the left. So the first thing we notice is that these two videos are compositionally identical. What are the odds of that? This is supposedly a live news event. We have two completely identical shots. Plane enters from the right, very quickly flies across, disappears perfectly behind the edge of the Twin Tower. And there's a frame missing. Okay, both of Chopper 7 and Chopper 5 display those characteristics. Now, neither one of these, none of the live 9/11 plane videos show a plane hitting the tower. Everyone that you will talk to, if you try to talk to them about this, says, but I saw the plane hit the tower on live television. No, you didn't. This is a perfect example of a psychological operation. You see the plane come in and disappear behind the edge of the tower. Right? Then later on you see an explosion. So logically, the plane must have hit the tower and caused the explosion. But that's a perfect example of how the human mind fills in the missing detail that it needs to in order to make the story make sense to it. Nobody saw a plane hitting the building on 9/11. Not on TV, they didn't. Those all came later. So that's the first thing to remember. So, but I'm still worried. I know I can superimpose a plane on here. I know I can mask the edge off. I'm still worried about this motion problem. How am I going to solve that? So I came and found out about this company called Sport Vision, and they make a product called First and Ten, which I think that that you've all seen. Let's see if I can find this now. It's called First and Ten. Let's see, is this going to let me go in? There we go. You've all seen this. That yellow stripe that's on the field is not really there. Okay? That's a virtual first down stripe that's being inserted live and in real time. Now, in order to do this, they had to solve the problem that we had when we were trying to make our little video, and that is, in regular chroma key, if you move the camera, then your overlaid object doesn't move, and so it spoils the show. So what they were able to figure out how to do is how to get that virtual first down stripe to move so that it looks like it's not moving. You follow? In order to get that first down stripe to look like it's holding still on the surface of the field, every time you move the camera, it has to move correspondingly. How do they do that? Well, they have sensors inside the base of the camera, okay? And when you pan the camera left, the sensor measures exactly how far left you move the camera. You tilt it up, same thing, zooming, same thing. It sends that information to the computer, and the computer can then move the overlay back and forth, make it bigger and smaller, so that it appears to track the camera movement. Could they have used this on 9/11 inside the helicopters to get the camera motion out of, to have the motion of the plane follow the camera motion of the live shot? The answer is no, because in the first and ten system, the base of the camera is mounted on terra firma. Okay? If you had that system up in a helicopter, yeah, you could pan the camera left and right and up and down, and it would track those camera movements. But it would not be able to track the movement of the entire helicopter. The entire helicopter is still moving, and you still wouldn't know what the camera motion is going to be. This was the moment for me. When I went through this, this was when the light bulb went off in my head. This was the epiphany for me. This is the problem they couldn't solve. You have to have helicopters because everybody expects the news helicopter shot. But you don't know what the camera motion is going to be. So I started studying on exactly what we see, and you might have to forgive me here, because on Jim's computer, and what was it, in Safari? Alright, was I able to bookmark this? Let's see. When in doubt, Google yourself. Let's see. Forgive me. I had this so together, but I guess, and I apologize. Some of these were going to be made bigger for better viewing, but this is just directly off of my web page. Are there scroll bars? Yes. Okay. So, the motion of a real airplane is stable. It is smooth. Right? You cannot have a real airplane flying through real air, speeding up and slowing down, speeding up and slowing down. It's physically impossible. Any changes in speed have got to be very gradual. Okay? The camera that is recording the motion of the airplane is recording snapshots in a very precise, precisely timed way. 29.97 snapshots every second. And therefore, if you have a stable shot of a real airplane, then the amount of distance that that airplane appears to cover in every frame has to be the same. It has to step along in a very, very controlled manner. So, what I did first was I went out and I shot my own control cases. And again, I apologize if these aren't aren't big enough. I had them bigger. But this is my plane, and I put a wire outline around it to mark the position of the plane, and it is indeed stepping across the screen in very, very regular intervals. I made sure that this plane that I photographed was actually farther away from me than the Chopper 5 plane, UA-175. Mine's about 5 miles away. The Chopper 5, the plane was about 4 miles away. And so I plot the motion of this aircraft, the velocity against time. And you can see that the motion is very, very stable. The velocity, that is the amount of distance that it moves across the screen, never varies by more than one pixel. Okay? So here I have a worse quality video of a plane, worse than the 9/11 videos. displaying this very stable motion. Next, I did a shaky camera one. All right, here, then, is frame by frame. Is that going to play? I hope, yeah. And you can see I'm moving the camera. I'm still trying to track the motion of that airplane, but it's a different airplane. You see, I'm moving the camera around, and of course, that is going to affect the apparent velocity of that airplane. Then I go, I take the same shot, and I stabilize it. So by stabilizing, I mean that I'm going to shift each frame of that video. I'm going to break the entire video down into frames, and I'm going to shift each one until the building is no longer moving, so that I can look at the video as if there had been no camera movement in it, or at least as little camera movement as possible. So the idea then is I'm going to compare the motion of this airplane before and after stabilizing to see what I can learn. And here's what I learned. I plot both of those on the same graph. Now the blue line shows you the unstabilized motion, and you can see it's all over the place. It's a wiggly line. After I stabilize the video, the line is straight. As we know, it needs to be in reality. We know the motion of the airplane is stable, so when we stabilize the video, that camera shake stuff comes out of it, and the line gets more straight. Okay? We know that when you stabilize an unstabilized picture of something that you know is stable in reality, the motion of that thing has to get more stable. It has to. There's no other direction for it to go. Alright, if I start with this case, with a perfectly stable graph line of a stable airplane, and then I then try to wiggle the camera on that, well, that line can't get any more straight. It's already a straight line. It can't get any more straight. The motion can't get any more smooth. So it only has one direction to go, and that is to get more unstable. Well, working backwards from that, okay, if I have an unstable video and I stabilize it, the graph line must get straighter. It has to go the other direction. It must. So then when I begin doing that same sort of analysis on Chopper 5, here I have my graph, and I mark out all the different things that happen in the video. Here's where the nose enters. Here's where it's partly hidden behind the logo. Here's the completely hidden frame. Here's where the nose hits the tower. See, I was sigh out there myself. I put nose hits tower, even though it actually just slips behind the edge. It doesn't. Here's where it's hidden. Here's where it comes out the other side. So I plot the velocity of that frame by frame, and you can see the velocity is very unstable. It appears to speed up, slow down, etc. After I stabilize the video, something very strange happens. Now, the blue line is my raw data, and the red line is my stabilized data. And what we see in this is that after I stabilized the video, the motion of that airplane became more unstable. So this is telling me that the camera motion on the background does not match the camera motion on the foreground. So just like that old 1930s movie that we saw, and we were able to bust them because the camera motion on that road didn't agree with the camera motion on the side of that car, well, it's the same kind of thing here. The camera motion does not agree. And so you might wonder, you know, well, you know, if that's true, you know, why didn't they stabilize the motion of that airplane first before they laid it onto the video? And what they did, I think, is they shot video of real airplanes or a real airplane, and then you put that on what's called an alpha channel. That's a transparency channel. And they can work with that for any amount of time. And I can show you actually one that I did myself. But they can do any, they can remove the background for it, they can move frames around, they could organize it any which way they wanted to. And yeah, if they wanted to, they could have made the motion of that airplane perfectly stable as it came across. Why didn't they do that? Okay. And the answer why they didn't stabilize the motion of that airplane is because that would have been a dead giveaway. You cannot get a perfectly stable airplane shot from a helicopter. If I see this perfectly smooth, advancing airplane that's moving the same number of pixels exactly, frame by frame by frame, but yet it's supposedly coming from a helicopter that's bobbing and weaving, I immediately know that that is a physically impossible shot. Or that it wasn't, but what could it have been taken from? There's, you know.
There are lots of things. It was taken from the FCS Future Combat System animation, which we can show if you can bring up the video up and up from DS registration. At the beginning of that, he shows the model shot and then the technician moving the building to match where the model has to be for the plane.
Right, I've seen that. What Rosalie is bringing up is yet another area of controversy within this area of controversy. And there are some who are saying, I'm believing they superimposed an airplane across this very brief shot. There are some who are saying that maybe the entire lower Manhattan was modeled, and that they were dragging foregrounds and backgrounds around all over the place. I don't know about some of that. Fred BS Registration has been doing a lot of work in that area. And there is definitely some strange things going on with that. Along the way, I discovered some interesting frames. This frame appears to have a whole bunch of pink stuff trailing behind the wing, and you know, I don't know how clear it is up there, but the colors behind the wing are a different color than the sky that, in reality. And I think the reason that they did that is they wanted to leave the pixels behind the wing because the exhaust of a jet will ripple the air in a way that you can see. And if that was missing, that too might be a giveaway that it wasn't real. So I think they had to keep, rather than just cutting the plane out exactly along the edge of the plane, I think they kept some air behind the wings so that they could get that ruffly effect. But unfortunately, I think the sky was a little bit more pink in their overlay than it really needed to be. So, and I started looking at Chopper 7 as well. I want to see how much of this I can get. All right, where's my window? Yeah, no, these aren't going to work. Okay. Well, I don't have my material on there.
It's a wrap. Good.
You know, a lot of people, they can't even look at 9/11. It's not even so much that they want to disagree with you. They just can't look at it. It's too intense. The implications of an inside job are very far-reaching, and it's immediately apparent to a lot of people. People think of their governments as the protector, the watcher. And while if it's an inside job, who protects us from the protector? You know, who watches over the watcher? And to the extent that there's an answer to that question, the answer is the news media is supposed to protect us. It's supposed to watch over the watcher. I mean, we think of Watergate and media heroes Woodward and Bernstein saved us from the evil Nixon. Right? Now, I would argue that of all the things that Nixon and his gang were up to, maybe the burglary and the spying on his political enemies and the cover-up was maybe the least of it, but the point is that media is supposed to watch over the watcher. Well, if the media are in on this too, who's left? Now, who's left? I mean, maybe it's time to just throw in the towel, surrender to the police state, and just resign.
No.
You know, it's when you think about the endless war and the battlefield and the prisons, it's pretty easy to become filled with despair. I would like to end on a note of optimism. 9/11 was fundamentally a psychological operation. It was a psyop. The battlefield, the most important battlefield, is in your mind. The prison is in your mind. So, the keys to unlock the prison are also in your mind. Now, it turns out that 9/11 and the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security and the endless war and the Federal Reserve and the corporatism and the whole stinking mess is founded upon and is propped up by and held together with a set of ideas. Nothing more than a set of ideas in your mind. And a set of ideas in your mind can disappear and be replaced by a different set of ideas instantly. Ideas can disintegrate faster than the Twin Towers. And that's pretty sad. Ladies and gentlemen, your government and your media showed you cartoons on 9/11. They passed it off as live news. But what you choose to do with that is up to you. Thank you very much.
AceBaker.com. In a moment, I'm going to entertain questions and give most of you an opportunity to make comments and invite a couple comments, including some from persons you haven't heard from before.